thought had wriggled from his heart returned to it, repentant and undeclared. He walked uncertainly to the door and let himself out, while I remained seated, seeing things with terrible clarity. The passivity, the hesitation about the future, not Israel's, mine. As Lucretia and I sat in the tiny room she called a studio, winter rain pricked the window pane, turning to ice. We'd pulled our chairs close to the hearth where the fire was snapping and popping, zinging like harp strings. Lucretia was opening a small packet of mail that had arrived in the afternoon. I was reading a Sir Walter Scott novel banned by the Quakers, which somehow made it all the more enjoyable. But now, drowsy with heat, I lowered the book and stared into the flames. It was my favorite part of the day, after the children were put to bed and Lucretia's husband James had retired to his study, and it was just the two of us gathered here in her odd little nook of a room. A studio. It was comprised of nothing more than two stuffed chairs, a large leafed table, a fireplace, wall shelves, and a wide window that looked out over a copse of red mulberries and black oaks behind the house. The room was not for cooking or sewing or child care or entertaining. Scattered with papers and pamphlets, books and correspondence, art palettes and squares of velvet cloth on which she pinned the bright luna moths she found lifeless in the garden, this room was just for her. I don't know how many evenings we'd spent in here talking, or like tonight, sitting quietly like two solitudes. Lucretia and I had formed a bond that went beyond friends, and yet I felt the difference between us. I noticed it at meetings when I saw her on the facing bench, the only female minister among all those men. The way she rose and spoke with such fearless beauty. And every morning when I went downstairs and there were her children sticky with oat gruel, I would get a faintly vacuous feeling in the pit of my stomach. Not from envy that she had a profession, or these little ones, or even James, who was not like other men, but of some unknown species, a husband who beamed over her profession and made the oat gruel himself. No, it wasn't that. It was the belonging I envied. She'd found her belonging. "Why, this letter is for you," Lucretia said, thrusting it toward me. It was Nina's stationery, but not Nina's script. The handwriting on the front was childlike and crude.
"Miss Sarah Grimke. Dear Sarah, Mama's back. Nina said I could write you myself with the news. She ran away from the plantation where she'd been kept all this time. You should see her. She has scars and a full head of white hair, and looks as old as Methuselah. But she's the same inside. I nurse her day and night. She brought my sister with her named Skye. I know that's some name. It comes from Mama and her longings. She always said one day we'd fly like blackbirds. Missus stays mad at Nina most all the time. Nina started some troubles at the Presbytery Church where she goes. Some man came last week to punish her on something she said. Mama and Skye are the one bright hope. It has taken too long to write this. Forgive my mistakes. I don't get to read any more and work on my words. One day, I will. Handful.
I hope it isn't bad news, Lucretia said, studying my face, which must have been a confusion of elation and heart wrench. I read the letter aloud to her. I hadn't spoken much about the slaves my family held, but I had told her about Handful. She reached over and patted my hand. We fell quiet as the ice turned back to rain, coming in a dark, drowning wash on the window. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine the reunion between Handful and her mother. The sister named Skye. Charlotte's scars and white hair.
Why would God plant such deep yearnings in us
if they only come to nothing. It was more of a sigh than a question. I was thinking of Charlotte and her longing to be free. But as the words left my mouth, I knew I was thinking of myself, too. I hadn't really expected Lucretia to respond, but after a moment, she spoke. God fills us with all sorts of yearnings that go against the grain of the world. But the fact that those yearnings often come to nothing, well, I doubt that's God's doing. She cut her eyes at me and smiled. I think we know that's men's doing. She leaned toward me. Life is arranged against us, Sarah. And it's brutally worse for Handful, and her mother and sister. We're all yearning for a wedge of sky, aren't we? I suspect God plants these yearnings in us, so we'll at least try and change the course of things. We must try. That's all. I felt her words tear a hole in the life I'd made. An irreparable hole. I started to tell her that as a child I'd yearned for the entire firmament, for a profession completely untried among women. I didn't want her to think I'd always been content to be a tutor, when I had little passion for it. But I pushed the confession aside. Even Nina didn't know about my aspiration to be a lawyer, how it had ended in humiliation. But you did more than try to become a minister. You accomplished it. I've often wondered whether one must feel a special call from God to undertake that. Quaker ministers were nothing like the Anglican or Presbyterian clergy I was used to. They didn't stand behind a pulpit and preach sermons. They spoke during the silence as inspired by God. Anyone could speak, of course, but the ministers were the most verbal, the ones who offered messages for worship, the ones whose voices seemed set apart. She pushed at the messy bun coiled at her neck. I can't say the call I felt was special. I wanted to have a say in things. That's what it came down to. I wanted to speak my conscience and to have it matter. Surely God calls us all to that. Do you think I could become a Quaker minister? The words had been tucked inside of me for a long time, perhaps since the moment on the ship when I first met Israel, and he told me female ministers actually existed. Sarah Grimke, you're the most intelligent person I know. Of course you could. Propped in bed, wearing my warmest woolen gown, my hair loosed, I bent over the bed desk and pewter inkstand I'd recently indulged in buying and tried to answer Handful's letter. 19 January, 1827. Dear Handful, what joyous news! Charlotte is back! You have a sister! I lowered the pen and stared at the procession of exclamations. I sounded like a chirping bird. It was my fifth attempt at a beginning. Strewn about me on the bed were crumpled balls of paper. How happy you must be now, I'd written first, then worried she might think I was implying all her miseries were over now. Next, I was euphoric to receive your news. But what if she didn't know the word euphoric? I couldn't write a single line without fear of seeming insensitive or condescending, too removed or too familiar. I remembered us, as I always did, on the roof drinking tea. But that was gone, and it was all balled up paper now. I picked up the sheet of stationery with the glib exclamations and crushed it in my hands. A smear of ink licked across my palm. Holding my hand aloft from Lucretia's white eiderdown, I lifted the bed desk from across my legs and went to the basin. When soap failed to remove the stain, I rummaged in the dresser drawer for the cream of tartar. And there, lying beside the bottle, was the black lava box containing my silver fleur-de-lis button. I opened it and gazed down at the button. It was darkly silvered, like something purling up from beneath the water. The button had been the most constant object in my life. I'd thrown it away that once, but it had come back to me. I could thank Handful for that. I returned to the warmth of the bed and placed the button on the bed desk, watching the lamplight spill over it. I lay back on the pillow, remembering my 11th birthday party at which Handful had been presented to me. How I'd woken the next day with the overpowering sense I was meant to do something in the world. Something large, larger than myself. I brushed my finger across the button. It had always held this knowing for me. In the room, everything magnified. Cinders dropping on the hearth, a tiny scratching at the baseboard, the smell of ink, the etch of the fleur-de-lis on the button. I took a clean sheet of stationery. 19 January, 1827. Dear Handful, my heart is full. I tried to imagine you with Charlotte and a new sister, and I can't dream what you must feel. I'm happy for you. At the same time, I'm sad to know of the scars your mother bears, all the horrors she must have lived through. But I won't focus on that now, only on your togetherness. Did you know once, when we were girls, Charlotte made me vow that one day I would do whatever I could to help you get free? We were out by the woodpile, where the little orphan barn owl lived. I remember it like yesterday. I confess now, that's why I taught you to read. I told myself reading was a kind of freedom, the only one I could give. I'm sorry, Handful. I'm sorry I couldn't keep the vow any better. I still have the silver button you rescued after I tossed it out. As I write you now, it sits beside the inkwell, reminding me of the destiny I always believed was inside of me, waiting. How can I explain such a thing? I simply know it, the way I know there's an oak tree inside an acorn. I've been filled with a hunger to grow this seed my whole life. I used to think I was supposed to become a lawyer, perhaps because that's what Father and Thomas did. But it was never that. These days I feel inspired to become a Quaker minister. Doing so will at least provide me a way to do what I tried to do on my 11th birthday, that day you were cruelly given to me to own. It will allow me to tell whoever might listen that I can't accept this. That we can't accept slavery. It must end. That's what I was born for. Not the ministry, not the law, but abolition. I've come to know it only this night, but it has always been the tree in the acorn. Tell your mother I'm glad she has found you again. Greet your sister for me. I've failed in many things, even in my love for you. But I think of you as my friend. Sarah.
Handful. That winter, Mama sat idle by the fire in the kitchen house. She got a little weight back on her, but sometimes she had spells where she couldn't keep down her food, and we'd be back where we started. Mama said every time she saw me, I was coming at her with a piece of biscuit. We had plenty of vacant slave quarters, but the three of us stayed on together in the cellar room. Goodis brought in a little bed from the nursery, and we wedged in it beside the big bed, and slept three peas in a pod underneath the quilt frame. Sky asked one time, what was all that wood nailed on the ceiling? And I said, you never seen a quilt frame? And Mama said, well, you ain't never seen a rice field, so y'all even. Mama still wouldn't talk about what had happened to her. She'd say, what's done is done. Most nights, though, she'd wake up and pace the room, and it didn't seem done at all. I realized the best curing thing for her was a needle, a thread, and a piece of cloth. One day I told her I needed some help, and handed her the mending basket. When I came back, the needle was a hummingbird in her fingers. The hardest part was finding work for Skye. She couldn't do the laundry to save her life. I got sorry to try her in the house cleaning and serving tea with me and Minta, but Mrs. said she didn't look the part and put off the guests. After that, she went to work in the kitchen house, but she drove Aunt Sister crazy with her chatter, stories about rabbits out-tricking foxes and bears. She usually ended up on the porch, singing in Gullah, "If una had nowhere, una de guan, una should know where una dem from." That same song over and over. If you don't know where you're going, you should know where you came from. One morning on the tail end of winter, the knocker clacked on the front door, and in came Mr. Hughie, the solicitor, stomping the cold off his feet. He handed me his hat while Sawby went to get Mrs. I found Nina in her room, readying for the class she taught at church. I said, "Quick, you need to come see what your mama's up to. Mr. Hughie's down there." She flew from the room before I could finish off the sentence. I dawdled outside the closed drawing room doors, but I couldn't make out much they were saying, just passing words. Pension. Bank. Cotton crash. Sacrifice. The clock bonged 10 times. The sound filled the house, turning it heavy, and when it stopped, I heard Mrs. say the word sky. Maybe she was talking about the blue roof that hung over the world, but I knew it was my sister. I flattened my ear to the door. Let Sawby find me and chase me off. I couldn't care. She's 13 years old without any perceivable domestic skills, but she's strong. That was Mrs. talking. Mr. Hughie mumbled about going rates, selling in the spring when the planting started on the plantations. "You can't separate Skye from her mother," Nina cried. "It's inhuman." "I don't care for it either," Mrs. said, "but we must face reality." My breath clutched at my ribs like grabbing hands. I closed my eyes, tired of the sorry world. When I found Mama in the kitchen house, she was alone with the mending basket. I sank beside her. "Mrs. plans to sell Skye in the spring. We got to find a way for her to earn her keep." "Sell?" She looked at me with stun, then pinched her eyes. "We ain't come this far so she can sell my girl. That's for damn sure. There must be something in the world Skye's good at doing." The way I said it, like my sister was slow in the head, caused Mama to flare at me. "Don't you talk like that. Your sister has the smart of Denmark in her." She shook her head. "He's her daddy. But I guess you figured that." "Yeah, I figured." It seemed like the time to finally tell her. "Denmark, he, there ain't a slave living who don't know what happened to him. We heard it all the way to Beaufort." I didn't tell her I'd watched him dangle on the tree, but I told her everything else. I started with the church where we'd sung Jericho. I told her about the workhouse, falling off the treadmill and crippling my foot. I told her the way Denmark took me in and called me daughter. "I stole a bullet mold for that man," I said. She pushed her fingers hard against her eyelids, trying to keep them from spilling over. When she opened them, there was a map in her eyes of broken red lines. "Skye asked me one time who her daddy is," she said. "I told her he was a free black in Charleston, but he's dead. That's all she know." "How come you don't tell her?" "Skye's got a child's way of talking out of turn. The minute you tell her about Denmark, she'll tell half the world. That ain't gonna help her. She needs to know about him. What she need is to keep from getting sold. The thing she know best is the rice fields. Put her to work in the yard." Skye took the ornament garden and brought it back to its glory. It came natural to her. How deep to bury the jonquil bulbs, when to cut back the roses, how to trim the hedges to match the drawings in a book Nina showed her. When Skye planted the vegetables, She shoveled horse shit from the stable and mixed it in the dirt. She dug straight furrows for the seeds and covered them with her bare foot like she done with the rice. She sang gullah songs to the plants when she hoed. When the beetles came, she picked them off with her fingers. Wouldn't you know, the crookneck squash came up the size of drinking gourds. The heads on the peonies were big pink soup bowls. Even Mrs. came out special to see them. As soon as the jonquils came up and turned the air choking sweet, she threw a garden tea for her friends that left them suffering with envy. Summer came, and Sky was still with us. "Where you keep the scrap cloth?" Mama said. She was rummaging through the lacquer sewing table in the corner of the cellar room. There was a basket on the floor beside her feet, heaped with spindles of thread, needle bags, pins, shears, and a measuring tape. "Scrap cloth, the same place it always was, in the patch bag." She reached for it. "You got some red and brown cotton in here?" "Always got red and brown cotton." I followed her to the spirit tree, where the crows hid up in the branches. She sat on Aunt Sister's old fish scaling stool with her back against the trunk and went to work. She cut a red square, then took the shears to the brown cloth and clipped the shape of a wagon. I said, "Is that the wagon the guard hauled you off in the day you disappeared?" She smiled. She was picking up with the rest of her story. She wouldn't say what happened to her with words. She would tell it in the cloth.
Sarah. When autumn came, Lucretia and I attended the women's meeting at Arch Street, where we found ourselves standing in a crowded vestibule beside Jane Bettelman, who glared pointedly at the fleur-de-lis button I'd sewed at the throat of my gray dress. Granted, the button was ornate and expensive, and it was large, the size of a brooch. I'd freshly polished the silver, so there in the bright-lit atrium it was shining like a small sun. Reaching up, I touched the engraved lily, then turned to Lucretia and whispered, "My button has offended Mrs. Bettelman." She whispered back, "Since you keep Mr. Bettelman upset a great amount of the time, it seems only fair you should do the same for his wife." I suppressed a smile. Arguably the most powerful figure at Arch Street, Samuel Bettelman criticized Lucretia and me on a weekly basis. During the past few months, the two of us had spoken out frequently in meetings on the anti-slavery cause, and afterward he would descend on us, calling our messages divisive. None of our members favored slavery, of course, but many were aloof to the cause, and they differed too on how quickly emancipation should be accomplished. Even Israel was a gradualist, believing slavery should be dismantled slowly over time. But what most rankled Mr. Bettelman and others in the meeting was that women spoke about it. "As long as we talk about being good helpmates to our husbands, it's well and good," Lucretia had told me once. "But the moment we veer into social matters, or God forbid politics, they want to silence us like children." She gave me courage, Lucretia did. "Miss Grimke, Mrs. Mott? How are thee?" a voice said. Mrs. Bettelman was at my elbow, her eyes flickering over my extravagant button. Before we could return the greeting, she said, "That's an unusually decorative item at your collar. I trust you like it?" I think she expected me to be apologetic. She rolled up her pale white lips, bringing to mind the fluted edges of a calla lily. "Well, it certainly matches this new personality of yours. You've been very outspoken in meetings lately." "I only try to speak as God would prompt me," I said, which was far more pious than true. "It is curious, though, that God prompts you to speak against slavery so much of the time. I hope you'll receive what I'm about to say for your own edification, but to many of us it appears you've become overly absorbed by the cause." Undaunted even by Lucretia, who took a step closer to my side, Mrs. Bettelman continued. There are those of us who believe the time for action has not yet come. Anger seared through me. You, who know nothing of slavery, nothing at all, you presume to say the time has not come? My voice sailed across the vestibule, causing the women to cease their conversations and turn in our direction. Mrs. Bettelman caught her breath, but I wasn't finished. If you were a slave toiling in the fields in Carolina, I suspect you would think the time had fully come. She turned on her heel and strode away, leaving Lucretia and me the object of shocked, silent stares. I need to find some air, I said calmly, and we walked from the meeting house onto the street. We kept walking past the simple brick houses and charcoal vendors and fruit peddlers, all the way to Camden Ferry Slip. We strolled past the ferry house onto the quay, which brimmed with passengers arriving from New Jersey. At the far end of the dock, a flock of white gulls stood on the weathered planks, facing the wind. We stopped short of them and stared at the Delaware River, holding on to our bonnets. Looking down, I saw that my hands were shaking. Lucretia saw it, too. She said, "You won't look over your shoulder, will you?" She was referring to the altercation, to the terrible inclination we women sometimes had to scurry back to safety. "No," I told her, "I won't look back." 16 February, 1828. Dear beloved sister, you're the first and only to know. I've lost my heart to Reverend William McDowell of Third Presbyterian Church. He's referred to in Charleston as the young, handsome minister from New Jersey. He's barely past 30, and his face is like that of Apollo in the little painting that used to hang in your room. He came here from Morristown when his health forced him to seek a milder climate. Oh, sister, he has the strongest reservations about slavery. Last summer, he enlisted me to teach the children in Sabbath school, a job I happily do each week. I once remarked on the evil of slavery during class and received a cautionary visit from Dr. McIntyre, the superintendent, and you should have seen the way William came to my defense. Afterward, he advised me that when it comes to slavery, we must pray and wait. I'm no good at either. He calls on me weekly, during which we have discussions about theology and church and the state of the world. He never departs without taking my hand and praying. I open my eyes and watch as he creases his brow and makes his eloquent pleas. If God has the slightest notion of how it feels to be enamored, he'll forgive me. I don't yet know William's intentions toward me, but I believe he reciprocates my own. Be happy for me. Yours, Nina. When Nina's letter arrived, I carried it to the bench beneath a red elm in the Mott's tiny backyard. It was a warm day for March. The crocuses were breaking through the winter crust, and the grasshoppers and birds were out, making a rapturous commotion. After tucking a small quilt over my knees, I arranged my new spectacles onto the end of my nose. Lately, words had begun to transform themselves into blurred squiggles. I thought I'd ruined my eyes from excessive reading. I'd been unrelenting in my studies for the ministry over the past year. But the physician I'd consulted ascribed the problem to middle age. I slit the letter, thinking, "Nina, if you could see me now with my old lady lap throw and my spectacles, you would think me 70 instead of half that." I read about her Reverend McDowell with what I imagined to be a mother's satisfaction and worries. I wondered if he was worthy of her. I wondered what mother thought of him, and if I would return to Charleston for the wedding. I wondered what kind of clergy wife Nina would make, and if the Reverend had any idea what sort of Pandora's box he was about to open. It will always be a quirk of fate that Israel arrived at this particular moment. I was folding the letter into my pocket when I looked up and saw him coming toward me without his coat or hat. it was the middle of the afternoon. He'd never mentioned the episode with Jane Bettelman. He undoubtedly knew of it. Everyone at Arch Street knew of it. It had divided the members into those who thought I was haughty and brazen, and those who thought I was merely impassioned and precipitate. I assumed he was among the latter. As he took a seat beside me, his knee pressed against my leg, and a tiny heat moved across my chest. He still had his beard. It was well clipped, but longer with more silver. I hadn't seen him in weeks except at meeting. There had been no explanation for his absence. I had told myself it was the inevitable way of things. I removed my glasses. Israel, this is unexpected. There was an exigency about him. I felt it like a disturbance in the air.
I've wanted to speak to you for some time, but I've resisted. I worried how you might receive what I have to say.
Surely this wasn't about the hubbub with Mrs. Bettelman. That had been months ago. Is there some difficult news? I asked.
I imagine this will seem abrupt, Sarah, but I've come determined to speak and let things fall or stand as they will. For 5 years now, I've struggled with my feelings concerning you.
I felt my breath suddenly leave me. He looked off toward the bare-boned trees at the perimeter of the yard.
I've grieved, Rebecca, perhaps too long. It became a habit, grieving her. I've been enthralled to her memory to the exclusion of too many things.
He bowed his head. I wanted to reassure him it was all right. But it had never been all right, and I remained quiet.
I've come to say, I'm sorry, he said. It seemed unfair to ask you to be my wife when I felt so tied to her.
It was an apology then, not a proposal. You don't need to apologize. He went on as if I'd said nothing.
Some weeks ago, I dreamed of her. She came to me holding the locket, the one Becky insisted you wear that time. She placed it in my hand. When I woke, it felt as if she'd released me.
I'd been staring miserably at my hands, but I gazed up at him, aware of how palpable the word released had been in his voice, how the moment was rearranging itself.
You must know I care deeply for you, he said. A man is not meant to be alone. The children are growing, but the younger ones still need a mother, and Greenhale is in need of a mistress. Catherine has expressed a wish to move back to her house in town. I'm saying it poorly. I'm hoping you'll be my wife.
I'd imagine this moment. I would feel an outpouring of joy. I would close my eyes and know that my life had truly begun. I would say, "Dearest Israel, yes." Everything in the world would be yes. It was not like that. What I felt was quiet and strange. It was happiness defiled by fear. For an imperishable minute, I couldn't speak. My silence distressed him.
Sarah, he said.
I want to say yes, and yet, as you know, I've set my course for a vocation, the ministry. What I mean to say is, could I be your wife and a minister? His eyes widened.
I hadn't imagined you would want to continue with your ambition after we married. Would you really want that?
I would, with all my heart. His face furrowed.
Forgive me, I only thought you chose it because you'd given up on me.
He thought my ambition was a consolation?
Reflexively, I stood and took a few steps. I thought of the knowing that had come to me about my mission on the night I wrote to Handful. It was pure as the voice that had brought me north. When I'd sewed the button on my dress, I knew it couldn't be undone. I turned back to him and saw he was on his feet, waiting. "I can't be Rebecca, Israel. Her whole life was for you and the children, and I would love you no less than she did, but I'm not like her. There are things I must do. Please, Israel, don't make me choose." He took my hands and kissed them, first one, then the other, and it came to me that I'd spoken of love, but he had not. He'd spoken of caring, of need. His, the children's, Green Hills. Wouldn't we be enough for you? He said. You would be a wonderful wife, and the best of mothers. We would see to it that you never missed your ambition. It was his way of telling me. I could not have him and myself both.
Handful. I spread a pallet under the tree and set my sewing basket on it. Mrs. had decided she needed new curtains and covers for the drawing room, which was the last thing she needed, but it gave me a reason to come out here and sew with Mama. She sat under the tree every day, working her story onto the quilt. Even if it drizzled, I couldn't budge her. She was like God mending the world. When she came to bed at night, she brought the tree with her, the smell of bark and white mushrooms, crumbs from the earth all over the mattress. Winter had come and gone. The leaves had wrinkled out on the tree branches, and the gold tassels were falling from the limbs like shedding fur. Settling on the pallet next to Mama, I wondered about Sarah up north, if her pale face ever saw the sun. She'd written me a while back, first letter I ever got. I carried it in my pocket most of the time. Thomas's wife had given Mrs. a brass bird that fastened cloth in his beak, what they called a sew bird. I stuck one end of the curtain panel in its mouth while I measured and cut. Mama was cutting out the applique of a man holding a branding iron in the fire. "Who's that man?" I said. "That's Master Wilcox," she said. "He branded me the first time we run off. Sky was about 7 then. I had to wait on her to get old enough to travel. Sky said y'all ran 4 times. We run the next year when she's 8, and then when she's 9. And that time they whip her too, so I stopped trying." "How come you tried this last time then?" "When I first get there, before Sky was born, Master Wilcox come down to see me. Everybody know what he want too. When he put his hand on me, I take a scoop of red coals off the fire and toss him, burn that man's arm clean through his shirt. I got my first whipping, but it's the last time he tried that with me. When Sky turned 13 last year, he come back sniffing around her. I tell her we leaving, and this time we gonna die trying." I couldn't measure words against any of that. I said, "Well, you made it. You're here now." Our needle started back. Over in the garden, Sky was singing. "If una had know where una de guan, una should know where una dem from." Sky had never set foot past the Grimke wall since she got here. Mrs. didn't have owner papers on her, and Nina said it was dangerous business out there. Since Denmark, the codes had got stricter, and the buckwheats had gotten meaner. But the next market day, I told Nina, "Right, Sky Pass, just do it for me. I'll watch after her." I tied a fresh scarf on Sky's head and wrapped a pressed apron round her waist. I said, "Now don't be talking too much out there, all right?" On the street, I showed her the alleys to duck in. I pointed out the guards, how to walk past and lower her eyes, how to step aside for the whites, how to survive in Charleston. The market was busy. The men carrying wood slats piled with fish, and the women walking around with vegetable baskets on their heads the size of laundry tubs. The little slave girls were out, too, selling peanut patties from their straw hats. By the time we passed by the butcher tables with the bloody calf heads lined up, Sky's eyes were big as horse hooves. "Where all this stuff come from?" she said. "You're in the city now," I told her. I showed her how to pick and choose what Aunt Sister needed. Coffee, tea, flour, cornmeal, beef rump, lard. I taught her how to haggle, how to do the money change. The girl could do numbers in her head quicker than me. When the shopping was done, I said, "Now we going somewhere, and I don't want you telling Mama or Goodis or anybody about it." When we came to Denmark's house, we stood on the street and looked at the battered whitewash. I'd come by here a few months after they lynched Denmark, and a free black woman I'd never seen answered the door. She said her husband had bought the house from the city, said she didn't know what came of Susan Vesey. I said to Sky, "You're always singing how we should know where we come from." I pointed to the house. "That's where your daddy lived. His name was Denmark Vesey." She kept her eyes on the porch while I told her about him. I said he was a carpenter, a big, brave-hearted man who had his wits sharper than any white man. I said the slave people in Charleston called him Moses, and he lived for getting us free. I told her about the blood he'd meant to spill, blood I'd long since made peace with. She said, "I know about him. They hung him." I said, "He would have called you daughter if he'd had the chance." We hadn't blown out the candle 5 minutes when Mama's voice whispered across the bed, "What happened to the money?" My eyes popped open. "What? The money I'd saved to buy our freedom. What happened to it?" Sky was already sleeping deep with a wheeze in her breath. She rolled over at our voices, mumbling nonsense. I raised on my elbow and looked at Mama laying in the middle between us. "I thought you took it with you. I was delivering bonnets that day. What would I be carrying all that money in my pocket for?" "I don't know," I whispered. "But it ain't here. I looked high and low for it." "Well, it's been right under your nose the whole time. If it was a snake, it'd bite you. Where's that first quilt you made? Has red squares and black triangles." I should have known. "I keep it on the quilt frame with the other quilts. Is that where you put it?" She whipped back the cover and climbed from bed, me fumbling behind her, lighting a candle. Sky sat up in the hot, sputtering dark. "Come on, get up," Mama told her. "We fixing to roll the quilt frame down over the bed." Sky lumbered over to us, looking confused, while I grabbed the rope and brought it down, the pulley wheels begging for oil. Mama dug through the pile in the frame and found the quilt near the bottom. When she shook it out, the old quilt smell filled the room. She slit the backing and sent her hand rooting inside. Grinning, she pulled out a thin bundle, then five more, all wrapped in muslin and tied with string so rotted it came apart in her hands. "Well, look here," she said. "What'd you find?" Sky asked. After we told her about the hiring out Mama used to do, and we danced around and poured over the riches, we laid the money on the frame, and I winched it back to the ceiling. Sky went on back to sleep, but me and Mama lay wide-eyed. She said, "Tomorrow first thing, you tie the money up fresh and sew it back inside the quilt. It's not enough to buy all three of us." "I know that. We just gonna hold on to it for now." The night drew on, and I started to drift, floating to the edge. Just before I went over, I heard Mama say, "I don't expect to get free. The only way I'm getting free is for you to get free."
Sarah. 13 April, 1828. Dearest Nina, last month, Israel proposed marriage. declaring himself at long last. You'll be surprised to learn I turned him down. He didn't want me to go on with my plans for the ministry, at least not as his wife. How could I choose someone who would force me to give up my own small reach for meaning? I chose myself, and without consolation. You should have seen him. He couldn't accept that a faded-looking woman in middle age would choose aloneness over him. Respectable, handsome Israel. When I delivered my answer, he asked if I felt ill, if I was myself. He explained the gravity of my mistake. He said I should reconsider. He insisted I speak with the elders, as if those men could ever know my heart. People at Arch Street can't conceive of my refusal any more than Israel. They think I'm selfish and misguided. Am I, Nina? Am I a fool? As the weeks pass without his visits, and I feel inconsolable, I fear I've made the worst mistake of my life. I want to tell you I'm strong and resolute, but in truth, I feel afraid and alone and uncertain. I feel as if he has died, and I suppose in some way it's true. I'm left with nothing but this strange beating in my heart that tells me I'm meant to do something in this world. I cannot apologize for it, or for loving this small beating as much as him. I think of you and your Reverend McDowell with hope and blessings. Pray for your loving sister, Sarah. I laid down the pen and sealed the letter. It was late, the Mott house asleep, the candle a nub, the night impervious on the window. For weeks, I'd resisted writing to Nina, but now it was done, and it seemed a turning point, an abdication of what I'd always been to her, mother, rescuer, exemplar. I didn't want to be those things anymore. I wanted to be what I was, her fallible sister. When Lucretia handed me Nina's letter, I was in the kitchen making biscuits the way Aunt Sister made them, with wheat flour, butter, cold water, and a spoonful of sugar. I wasn't inclined toward baking, but I did try to be of help now and then. I opened the letter, standing over the bowl of flour. 1 June, 1828. Dearest sister, take heart. Marriage is overvalued. My own news, though not as dire as yours, is similar. Some weeks ago, I went before a meeting at church and requested the elders give up their slaves and publicly denounce slavery. It was not well received. Everyone, including Mother, our brother Thomas, and even Reverend McDowell, behaved as if I'd committed a crime. I asked them to give up a sin, not Christ and the Bible. Reverend McDowell agrees with me in spirit, but when I pressed him to preach publicly what he says to me in private, he refused. Pray and wait, he told me. Pray and act, I snapped. Pray and speak. How could I marry someone who displays such cowardice? I have no choice now but to leave his church. I've decided to follow in your steps and become a Quaker. I shudder to think of the gruesome dresses in the barren meeting house, but my course is set. Fine riddance to Israel. Be consoled in knowing the world depends upon the small beating in your heart. Yours, Nina. When I finished reading, I pulled a chair from the pine table and sat. Motes of flower dust were drifting in the air. It seemed an odd convergence that Nina and I would both taste this pain only weeks apart. Fine riddance to Israel, she'd written. But it wasn't fine. I feared I would love him the rest of my life, that I would always wonder what it would have been like to spend my life with him at Green Hill. I longed for it in that excruciating way one has of romanticizing the life she didn't choose. But sitting here now, I knew if I'd accepted Israel's proposal,
I would have regretted that, too. I'd chosen the regret I could live with best, that's all. I'd chosen the life I belonged to. I'd struggled for nearly 2 years to be acknowledged as a minister, without success, and I bore down now on my efforts, performing charitable work at the children's asylum in order to win over the Quaker women, and spending so many evenings reading texts on Quaker thought and worship, I smelled perpetually of paraffin. The crucial factor, though, was my utterances in meeting, which were completely dismal. My nervousness about speaking always made my stammer worse, and Mr. Betterman complained loudly about my incoherent mumblings. It was said that rhetorical polish wasn't required for the ministry, but the fact was all the ministers on the facing bench were appallingly eloquent. I sought out the doctor who'd provided my spectacles, in hope, finally, of a cure. But he terrified me with talk of operations in which the root of one's tongue was sliced and the excess tissue removed. I left, vowing I would never return. That night, unable to sleep, I sat in the kitchen with warm milk and nutmeg, repeating, "Wicked Willy Wiggle," over and over, the little tongue exercise Nina had once insisted I do when she was a child. 8 October, 1828. My dear Sarah, I am to be publicly expelled from Third Presbyterian Church. It seems they do not take well to my attending Quaker meetings these past few months. Mother is appalled. She insists my downfall began when I refused confirmation into St. Philip's. According to her, I was a 12-year-old marionette whose strings you pulled, and now I'm a grown marionette of 24 whose strings you're manipulating all the way from Philadelphia. How skilled you are! Mother also felt compelled to add that I'm an unmarried marionette, thanks to my pride and my opinionated tongue. Yesterday, Reverend McDowell visited, informing me I must return to the fold of God's elect, or be summoned before the church session to stand trial for broken vows and neglect of worship. Have you ever? I spoke as calmly as I could. Deliver your document citing me to appear in your court, and I'll come and defend myself. Then I offered him tea. As Mother says, I'm proud. Proud even of my pride. But when he departed, I fled to my room and gave way to tears. I am on trial. Mother says I must give up my Quaker foolishness and return to the Presbyterians or bring public scandal upon the Grimkeys. Well, we've endured them before, haven't we? Father's impeachment, that despicable Burke Williams, and your awing desertion to the North. It's my turn now. I remain firm. Your sister, Nina. Over the next year, my letters to Nina were the nearest thing to a diary I'd written since Father's death. I told her how I practiced saying Wicked Willy Wiggle, of the fear my voice would keep me from realizing my largest hopes. I wrote of the anguish of seeing Israel each week at meetings, the way he avoided me while his sister, Catherine, warmed to me considerably, a volte-face I couldn't have imagined when I first returned here. I sent Nina sketches I drew of the studio and recounted the talks Lucretia and I had there. I kept her abreast of the livelier petitions that circulated in Philadelphia, to keep free blacks from being turned out of white neighborhoods, to ban the colored bench in meeting houses. "It has come as a great revelation to me," I wrote her, "that abolition is different from the desire for racial equality. Color prejudice is at the bottom of everything. If it's not fixed, the plight of the Negro will continue long after abolition." In response, Nina wrote, "I wish I might nail your letter onto a public post on Meeting Street." The thought of that was not at all unpleasant to me. She wrote of her battles with Mother,
the dryness of sitting in the Quaker meeting house, and the rampant ostracism she faced in Charleston for doing so. "How long must I remain in this land of slavery?" she wrote. Then, on a languid summer day, Lucretia placed a letter in my hands. 12 August, 1829. Dear Sarah, several days ago, en route to visit one of the sick in our meeting, I was standing on the corner of Magazine and Archdale when I encountered two boys. They were mere boys, escorting a terrified slave to the workhouse. She was pleading with them to change their minds, and seeing me, she begged more tearfully, "Please, missus, help me." I could do nothing. I see now that I can do nothing here. I am coming to you, sister. I will quit Charleston and sail to Philadelphia in late October after the storms. We shall be together, and together nothing shall deter us. With abiding love, Nina. I'd been expecting Nina for over a week, keeping vigil at the window of my new room in Catherine's house. The November weather had been spiteful, delaying her ship. But yesterday the clouds had broken. Today, surely today. On my lap was a slender compendium on Quaker worship, but I couldn't concentrate. Closing it, I paced back and forth in the narrow room, an unadorned little cell similar to the one that awaited Nina across the hall. I wondered what she'd think of it. It had been hard to leave Lucretia's, but there was no guest room there for Nina. Israel's daughter-in-law had taken over Green Hill, allowing Catherine to move back to her small house in the city, and when she'd offered to board the both of us, I'd accepted with relief. I went again to the window and peered at the outcroppings of blue overhead, and then at the river of elm leaves in the street, brimming yellow, and I felt surprised suddenly at my life. How odd it had turned out. How different than I'd imagined. The daughter of Judge John Grimke, a southern patriot, a slaveholder, an aristocrat, living in this austere house in the north, unmarried, a Quaker, an abolitionist. A coach turned at the end of the street. I froze for a moment, arrested by the clomp-clomp of the chestnut horses, the way their high stride made eddies in the leaves. And then I broke into a run. When Nina opened the door of the coach and saw me rushing toward her without a shawl, my hair falling in red skeins from its pins, she began to laugh. She wore a black full-length cloak with a hood, and tossing it back, she looked dark and radiant. "Sister," she cried, and stepped off the carriage rung into my arms.
Part 6, July 1835 to June 1838. Handful. I stood by the bed that morning, looking down on Mama still sleeping, the way she had her hands balled under her chin like a child. I hated to wake her, but I patted her foot and her eyes rolled open. I said, "You feel like getting up? Little Missus sent me out here to get you." Little Missus was what we called Mary, the oldest Grimke daughter. She turned a widow the first of the summer, and before they got her husband in the ground good, she'd handed off the tea plantation to her boys, said the place had kept her cut off from the world too long. Next we know, she showed up here with 9 slaves and more clothes and furniture than we could fit in the house. I heard Mrs. tell her, "You didn't need to bring the entire plantation with you." And Mary said, "Would you prefer I'd left my money behind too?" Just when Mrs. had got where she couldn't swing the gold-tipped cane with the strength of a 3-year-old, here came little Mrs., ready to pick up the slack. She had lines round her eyes like dart seams and silver thread in her hair, but she was the same. What we remembered most from when Mary was a girl was the bad way she treated her waiting maid Lucy, Benna's other girl. On the day Mary got here with her procession, Phoebe bolted from the kitchen house, shouting, "Lucy! Lucy!" When nobody answered, she rushed up to Little Missus and said,